I'm happy to be here, mainly because I'm actually presiding a session over in the Renaissance Hotel, which I excused myself briefly to come give this talk. So
I appreciate it.
It's been one of those days. So I want to update you on some of the progress that's been ongoing with the Global Soul Map project in the U.S., and particularly how we're dealing with some of the uncertainty components that Alex mentioned that are part of the specifications. We recognize that the efforts to produce these global soil map products are going to utilize legacy conventional soil maps as their primary source of input, given the other restrictions on the process. And so I will share with you some of our results comparing different sources and different manipulations of these conventional soil maps to produce the global soil map property estimates and the prediction intervals. I'm going to review some previous work on doing this on a national scale and then introduce some more recent efforts to look at more of a landscape, local scale for assessing these prediction intervals. For those who aren't familiar with the Global Soil Map Project, it's an effort to produce a gridded soil property map for the entire globe, up to 13 functional soil properties at 6 depth intervals, and including uncertainties for all of these estimates. And the uncertainties take the form of a 90% prediction interval. Again, the way we're going to produce these in many countries where we have existing legacy conventional soil maps is to do spatially weighted means of those maps, and when possible, some spatial disaggregation to look at within mapping unit variability and making predictions of variability within map units. For our first version of these products for the U.S., we are using the U.S. General Soil Map, or StatsGo 2, as you may know it. This is a relatively coarse-scale vector soil class map, 1 to 250,000 scale. It represents that soil variability with up to 21 components per map unit, but for each of those components you have horizon data, a high, a low, and a representative value for those properties that it includes. And so to develop our global soil map estimates, this is an example, a hypothetical, a very simplified map unit with three components, A, B, and C, with those aerial percentages, aerial extents within the map unit, and to come up with the spatial or the estimate of the individual property, it's just a simple spatially weighted mean based on those extents. So for this example, it would be about a 3.5. For the prediction interval limits, the upper and lower values, instead of doing a spatially weighted mean of the high and low values, we decided to take a more simplified approach. And for the lower limit, we took the lowest of the low values, so in this case it would be 1, and for the upper limit, we took the highest of the high values, and so in this case 6. And so this is how we constructed those prediction interval limits from the legacy data. This is how we developed those maps. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here discussing those. If you are very interested, you can read one of those papers that I cite there, a paper by Nathan Odgers in Geoderma from 2012, or a paper from Jordan Helmick in the recently published Global Soil Map book. Here's, again, just to show you some of our results of this map before I get into the actual evaluation. This is just one property, soil organic carbon. I'm going to toggle through the 6 depth increments. So here's the surface. The yellow colors are high carbon, the blue colors are low carbon. So if you want to pick a certain part of the country and zoom in there for yourself, you can focus as I cycle through. And not unexpectedly, the carbon content goes down with depth in many locations. Okay. So again, we also have the prediction intervals. This is the two prediction interval maps for clay content of the upper 5 centimeters of the soil, the lower limit in the lower left, the upper limit in the upper right. Dark colors are low values of clay, light colors are high values in clay. And again, you can see some of the general patterns of the soils across the U.S. Right. So again, those are the products we're trying to evaluate. How would we do this? We took PEDON data from the National Soil Characterization Database, where we had information on clay content, organic carbon, and pH. These are the three soil properties we chose to evaluate for this exercise, looking at all 6 depth increments, and basically calculated the percentage of those PEDON points that were captured by the prediction interval that we created. This is a map showing the distribution of those PEDONs across the U.S. The points that have no halo are ones that fell within the specified prediction interval. The ones with the halos were either above or below that prediction interval. And you see there is some clustering of those values across the U.S. But in general, we had a fairly good distribution across the country. So again, our overall goal was to have a prediction interval that covered 90% of the observations. And based on those PEDONs for organic carbon across all depth increments, it was 87.6 for carbon, 90.6 for pH, and 86.4 for clay content, which I think is a pretty good approximation of 90%. Prediction interval coverage was generally consistent amongst the 6 depth intervals. There wasn't one depth that particularly was more or less good of a match. But what we found is those prediction interval widths may be too large for practical use. So this is the median prediction interval width for those samples. So almost a 2% carbon. Almost a 3-unit pH range from high to low, and over 30% clay content, which that covers a lot of ground within those bounds. And this is a map that shows prediction interval width, with green being a narrow prediction interval, red being a very wide prediction interval across the U.S. This is clay content 5 to 15 centimeters. And you can see there are significant areas that are have a prediction interval of 50% clay or more. And so while we were pleased that we were able to hit the prediction interval pretty well, we weren't excited about those widths. And so we thought, well, maybe if we looked at, we weren't basing these on the StatsCode 2 data that had up to 21 components, if we could sort of reduce that variability within the map units, that might improve our results. So we embarked on a more regional or a landscape scale study. This is in the southern high Allegheny Mountains of West Virginia. We looked at conventional soil maps from Webster and Pocahontas counties, West Virginia. You can see those in that map. This included the Sergo data, which is the more detailed polygon class map that's available for the U.S. Unlike the StatsCo, which was 1 to 250, we're talking about 1 to 24,000, so a larger map scale. But still aggregated map units, but fewer map units per polygon. And also, like StatsCo, we had estimated soil properties for each component, high, low, and representative values. We also wanted to look at the disaggregation and see if that would help us in this endeavor. And so again, I'm not going to go into great detail on this disaggregation approach. It's published by Travis Nauman earlier this year in Geoderma. Again, you can read all about it. But again, using the information in Sergo to define the areas that meet the concept of each of the components, and then using a random forest model to predict where those individual components within those map units should occur, and then assigning properties. For the Surgo, we did it the same way as with StatsGo 2, just a spatially weighted average of all components. And then with the prediction interval limits, it was the lowest low and the highest high. For DSurgo, or disaggregated, we did it two different ways. One where we took the weighted average of the top three most likely soils based on the model output, and one where we took the representative value for the most likely soil in each particular pixel. Okay. Again, just to show you some of the maps, this is carbon content 5 to 15 centimeters. Low on the left, representative value in the center, high in the right. StatsGo 2 on the top, Surgo in the middle, and one of the two disaggregated maps on the bottom. And so you can see the differences in those different sources of data, how they represent the spatial variability. There's not much in StatsGo 2 because of its coarse scale. See more detail in the Surgo data, but you also see the county line between Webster and Pocahontas counties, with higher carbon in Pocahontas County, which is in part due to its higher elevation forests in that part of the state. And then you see when we disaggregate that, it creates what I suppose would pass the eye test for a soil scientist. It seems to give us a much more realistic representation of those soil landscape relationships. And it also removes that county line discrepancy. Similarly, we had some PEDON data from a master's research project, 97 points. Again, looking at percentage of points that were captured by the prediction intervals that we determined, and also looked at the mean prediction interval width. I'm presenting this with bar charts here. Prediction interval coverage is on the left. The red line is that desired 90% threshold. And then the prediction interval width is on the right. I don't think we need to get too worried about the actual values, but you can see the differences in the heights of those bars. For clay content, which is shown here, we see as we get deeper in the profile, we get closer to and even exceed that prediction interval of 90%. But along with that, the prediction interval width increases with depth, which is actually quite understandable if you think about soils and clay increases with depth. And so it makes sense that way. We can do the same thing with organic carbon. Here we note that for the disaggregated maps, the prediction intervals are much closer to that 90% target, unlike the two conventional soil maps. And again, as we might expect, understanding carbon distribution in soils, the prediction interval widths are largest at the surface and decrease with depth, as we know that carbon tends to increase or decrease with depth. And again, the same thing with pH. For all of these data sources, we seem to get a pretty high prediction interval coverage and slight differences in the mean prediction interval width. But in general, it seems that those disaggregated products tend to approximate that 90% prediction interval width better than the base conventional survey maps. So the map where we had took the average of the three most likely soils, it had the most consistently high prediction interval coverage, but also had relatively higher prediction interval widths. If we go to the single component estimate, it had the second most consistent PI coverage, but slightly narrow prediction interval widths. And so, at least with these data, it seems there's a trade-off. If you want to approximate that 90% prediction interval using these legacy data, you're ending up with a wider prediction interval. But somewhat disappointingly, and this will sort of be my last point here, is that the prediction accuracy and the fit was fairly weak with these, when we look at just not the prediction intervals, but the predicted values. And so if you looked at the simple correlation between the individual soil properties on those 97 PEDONs that were measured from those PEDONs versus the estimated from the maps, you're only getting an R-squared around 9, which is not very good. And fairly high RMSEs. Soil organic carbon was the poorest, and it seemed like pH was slightly overestimated comparing the observed data to the to the estimated from the maps. And so I'll leave with this figure. It shows those scatter plots of the measured versus estimated properties for, in this case, it's clay content from 30 to 60 centimeters, but I have all of the possible combinations. And you can see it's not a very good relationship between the estimate and the observed from our PEDON data. And so I guess the take home there is that, yes, we can disaggregate these maps, and there's many examples of how disaggregation is being implemented to look at that sub-map unit variability. But when we go to map the properties, if we're still basing those properties on the estimates from the legacy soil data, you're still not getting a very good soil property map. And so while we might be able to improve the spatial structure of the data, that the property estimates that we're using to generate these maps are key to making sure that we can represent that variability in a reliable way. So, disaggregation is not the silver bullet.
Yeah. I had a question about how you chose the most likely soils in those disaggregated cases. Mm-hmm.
It was a tree model, random forest, and so it's an ensemble method. And so I can't remember how many model runs, but it would be the soil individual component that came up out of 100 times most frequently in those ensemble models. And then the second most would be our second. So when the three would be the top three out of those 100 times we run the model. Does that make sense? All right.